program that we have at in the Palm Beach County area, and how that kind of fits into some of the other coverages that we do locally. Let me just give you a little background on the healthcare district. We were created by a referendum by the voters of Palm Beach County, because occasionally the voters in Palm Beach County do an election right and make a good decision. Back in 1988, we're going on our 20th anniversary this year, and underneath this referendum, we tax property, an ad valorem tax, to run healthcare services in Palm Beach County. And here's a list of the ones we do. It's very diverse. And when people kind of come in sometimes, they say, you know, how does that all fit? But we do the aeromedical piece of trauma. We run the trauma centers in the county. We have our health coverage programs, which we'll talk a little more about. We have a registered nurse in every public school in Palm Beach County, and that's 150 schools. We run a nursing home and hospital. And our mission, as far as this piece, is to increase our coverage options to the uninsured. And our uninsured rate is very high in Palm Beach County. People think of great wealth, and there is great wealth there, but it takes a lot of people to support that great wealth. And those people who do the landscaping and the folks who work in the service industries and hospitality industries basically are uninsured. And they do not have any options for coverage in a number of cases. Approximately 80% experience an income less than 300% of federal poverty guidelines. And our health coverage programs, we have three that have been around for quite a number of years. First is our coordinated care program, which is your typical indigent care. A little bit different in Palm Beach County in that the dollars follow the patient. We don't have a lot. We have one public hospital, one public nursing home. Out of the 13 hospitals in Palm Beach County, 9 of them are run by for-profit companies. And we have contracts with them to take care of our patients. But we make the patient eligible, give them a little insurance card like they would get from insurance, and they can carry that around to providers. Big network of docs. We have about 1,200 doctors in the program. Our oldest program is this coordinated care, which goes up to 150%. There is an eligibility process required for this, and it's a four-part where you have to document you live in the county, you have to be able to identify yourself, and then there's an income and asset test, and that is verified. Healthy Palm Beaches, we also run a state-licensed HMO. So this treats the TANF population. Eligibility is determined by the state. We have to follow all the state rules and regs for HMO. And then our maternal care program basically makes sure we cover all our pregnant women in the county up to 200% of federal poverty guidelines. They have to show they're not sober eligible or eligible for anything else, and then we put them in that program. In 2005, the state of Florida had this law to create what are called health flex plans, and the goal of this law was to expand coverage to the uninsured and emphasizing programs that would be basic and preventive health services. These are not insurance products. There's about 42 or 43 musts that you have to do under state insurance law. This kind of negates a lot of them. And it allows you to kind of put together a series of benefits. Now, it still has to be signed off by the Department of Insurance at the state, but once they sign off on it, you're kind of good to go with your benefit structure. And there are several of these in the state of Florida now. There's been up to 6 of them. Mostly by local governments, and they've really had limited success. Many of them lack an inpatient benefit, and just recently we've been able to go up a little higher on the federal poverty limit for guidelines so we can ensure we can cover up to 300%, and that's going to help us a little bit with our coverage. So we started this VITA program in June of 2006, and since we already had an existing provider network that included hospitals and physicians and labs and everything you need, it was really pretty easy to kind of dovetail it into that using that existing structure. What's different, though, is that we had to come up with a way for people to pay a premium. None of our other programs do people pay any premium. So that was a new skill for us to learn. And we have a shared premium where actually the district covers 2/3 of the cost of the product, and then the patient has a shared cost, which is anywhere from $25 to $100 monthly. And that's done, it's an actuarial thing by age. So the kids pay 25. If you're between the ages of 54 and 64, you pay that 100 a month, and then there's some other in between. The eligibility is self-declared, which is makes it a lot easier. You don't have to go through that verification process of all those documents. And you also have to be uninsured for 6 months, and that's state law. And the state decided they didn't want people, you know, opting out of their Blue Cross at work and, you know, going right into this product. So they make you have a six-month wait period. Initially, again, we started out with a 200% level and then went up to 300%. And our benefits, we do have hospital days, which makes ours a little different than some of the other programs. And we do 10 hospital days, which you think, oh, my goodness, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot of days, and this is per year. Medicaid in Florida covers 45 days per year. But some of the studies that we've done with our other population, the average length of stay per year in the hospital is like less than 7 days. So most people are covered by that. It's unlimited physician and specialist visits, laboratory and x-ray services. We only cover generic meds, and there's a limit to that per month. And then there's a bunch of excluded services and diagnoses because, you know, again, this is a cost-effective product, and so many things like transplants and various kinds of therapies are going to be excluded. Here's been our membership, and as you can see, it was kind of slow to take off, and it still is pretty slow, because when you think of we're talking about having 200,000 people uninsured and maybe 60 or 70,000 might be eligible for this program, we're barely hitting 1,200. Now, after all the economic problems this summer that we've had in Florida and throughout the country, membership for November is up to 2,000, and we kind of think it'll continue to increase with the economy being the way it is. And here's how the membership is made up. And very surprisingly, it's older folks. And when you think about the folks who are eligible for Medicaid, it's generally easy if you're a child or a female or a young woman you know, who has children to get Medicaid eligibility. And here we see it's older folks. You know, we only have about 15% under the age of 21, 85% over. You can see the breakdown by ages. And really, when you look at it, the 21 to 54 age group is pretty significant, as is the 55 plus. And again, this goes back to June. Now, top physician diagnoses. So what are people going into the doctor for? So it is, when you look at it, are a lot of preventive services, and that sort of makes you feel good. Hypertension, or routine med and gyne exams, abdominal pain, low back pain. Now, top diagnostic procedures, I'm not sure I feel so good about this one because it's colonoscopy, and certainly that could be preventive for a lot of people, but you always wonder if your GI folks aren't getting a little scam in the system. So, you know, we got to pull charts and look at that. Was it verified? And, most of the time it is. So future directions. Well, one problem, as you saw, was that we really think we've got a bigger market out there that people haven't signed up. So we've done a number of things to try to increase enrollment. Now, here's one that I didn't think was such a good idea, but this was put in the print newspapers. You know, and who reads print newspapers anymore? And do the people read print newspapers anymore? I guess they do, but this also then went on the pharmacies, and we've been partnering with Walgreens and CVS, which are the two big providers down in our area, to have them right next to their list of $4 generic drugs, you know, so hopefully somebody would pick that up. We put it in ERs where people may come in. We're going to start targeting small businesses, and we've kind of talked about that, you know, Palm Beach tends to have a lot of hospitality industries, a lot of lawn services that may employ a few people. So we're doing that through the business groups. We're starting to do group enrollment for some of those. And then we have a number of children in Palm Beach County that are non-Title 21 kids that we pay to be in Florida Healthy Kids. And these are kids that were grandfathered in before they had some of the eligibility requirements. So we're kind of looking at maybe moving them out of that plan into this one. Thank you.
Well, first off, I want, as a moderator, I have to say what a great honor it is to work with five brilliant people who all were able to provide their presentations within their time limits. So that's always a moderator's dream. So anyway, we do have some time for questions, and let's see if there are any questions that people have out there for the speakers. And if you have it directed for somebody, why don't you identify who you'd like to answer the question. So go ahead, the woman here. Maybe you should use the mic because I think it's being recorded.
The California Healthcare Foundation asked us to continue to collect monthly data for a year following the collaborative so that they could have that to study. No controls, no formal controls. No.
The gentleman in the back.
That's me.
Yeah, and it was really interesting to see the breakdown of the different factors. I'm wondering if you looked at all at state variations. It seems that there might be some differences in enrollment policies by state, but it could also be in the state.
So, could you maybe repeat parts of the question?
Yes. The question was asked, in our study, did we look at state variations? That's a brilliant question. And I promise you are not a plant in the audience because we're doing another study focusing on simply on geographic variations in both uninsurance, periods without health insurance, and underinsurance. So thank you. I mean, it was, yes, you're right. That's very important. Because all states have different policies on Medicaid and SCHIP, and so we're linking this data set to contextual level state factors on those in those areas.
There's a question here, yes. You, yes.
For the eligibility worker collaborative again, who is on the team? I mean, like in a clinical collaborative, you know, you have a doc and an MA and a nurse and an administrator. Is this just eligibility workers and do you have managers or?
The question is for a process improvement collaborative, who are the folks that are on a team? We are limited to four slots in terms of funding. Some teams expanded that to seven, added those folks at their own expense. We asked that there be a policy expert. Usually that is a supervisor. We ask that there be a frontline worker. Some of the teams that are more advanced have added, and depending on their resources, have added a data person, always manager level. And we build in, not necessarily on the teams that come to the face-to-face meetings, but we are building in more and more steps to reach out to the director of the organization. If the top leadership doesn't make a commitment in the change, the eligibility workers can only go so far.
I have a follow-up question to that. Do you know of any funding sources for doing that kind of collaborative in other states?
The Louisiana project, the state applied for a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant and received that, and then they matched it. So foundation fundings, particularly when you can match it with the federal dollar, are the most likely sources.
You might as well stay up there. One of the things that's going to be enacted in January of 2009 is that people in California, with their
The question or comment is, with pending changes in California eligibility to go from a 12-month eligibility determination period to a 6-month, is it that going to make the process just... Absolutely. You're doubling the volume of demand on the system. We have seen states that have done that, and then after a few years, they reduce, go back to a 12-month period. It is not a cost-effective method to try to control the population because you accumulate more and more cost, particularly in areas where there's shared funding of administration. Local level county workers, county offices may be paying overtime to another workforce to try to keep up with the demand because compliance with federal policies is not relieved. It's an additional burden. The sad thing is it's very burdensome to the families. States could do a 6-month period in a reasonable way if they followed the federal statute, which is before you terminate, you must make sure that a family individual is not eligible for any category of Medicaid. And the other part of that statute is you should redetermine eligibility based on information available to you, not depend on the family to get it, called ex parte. California can't do ex parte because they require signature at renewal. With that signature requirement is one of the things we pointed out. Workers could go into the various systems, verify information as being current, and make a decision. But there would be other policies. I'm sorry to hear California's going to do that. The question was about, are there studies related to the cost of having more frequent redetermination periods? I'm not going to say there are academic studies, but if you look at data over time in the few states who have gone to 6-month redeterminations and then have rescinded that later, you see just tremendous changes in caseloads. It certainly has a dampening effect on caseload growth. If you give me your card, I can send you some places to look for that.
I know some advocacy groups that do work tracking that, and the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities usually has some good numbers about Medicaid enrollment redetermination, along with, I know Tennessee went through a very tumultuous time, and the Tennessee Justice Center has some studies out about redetermination, and also Families USA also tracks that information. But if you need more, feel free to come up after.
So are there any other questions? If not, I want to thank Dr. Deirdre Byrne, Tegan McGowan, Dr. Michael Kogan, Dr. Ron Wiwara, and Dr. Vicki Grant, all who have provided us with remarkable information. Thank you again, and we're adjourned.
Thank you for moderating. Very good job.
We'll get in and out of time. Oh.
Right.